is. Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. And for those of you who are joining us for the very, very first time, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. You know, it's a good habit to get into, and I certainly hope that those of you who are new to the show will get into that habit. The swine flu, you know, it's in the news, it's out of the news, it's in the news again, and when we first started hearing about it, we were being told, you know, what a terrible, terrible pandemic awaited us, and then it seemed like, okay, it didn't happen, and then the news people started sort of playing it down. Well, they shouldn't play it down. It hasn't gone away. And it's a weird flu. Now, when they first started talking about the swine flu on the news, they were talking about how at the very beginning, they were talking, a lot of the scientists and doctors were talking about how this didn't look like a normal flu. It looked like that it was perhaps manufactured. Now, I'm not fanning the flames of that, but you remember that is what they were saying. Well, now, and all that sort of went away. And you need to understand that listening to this show almost every night, we've got tons of government computers logged in, and I'm glad they're here. I've got no problem with that. I'm looking for listeners, whoever they are. But among them, I have found previously, not I haven't looked recently, but previously, I have found computers from the CDC have logged in. I've found computers from the National Institute of Health has logged in, and others. And I tell you that because I want you to understand that when I mention anything like this, I start getting emails. I suspect from whoever's listening on those computers telling me how foolish I am to even suspect something like that. Well, the fact that I report that some doctor said it doesn't mean I suspect it. It means some doctor said it. Well, what they found out now about this swine flu is that this strain of flu is really different from the seasonal flu that comes along each year. The seasonal flu that comes along each year inhabits your head, your nose, your sinus passages, etc., and you just feel awful. But the swine flu, this strain of flu that's going around now, invades the entire respiratory system, and it gets into your lungs and causes lesions in your lungs. Well, they've also just found, and that's one of the reasons it's so dangerous, but they've also found that about a third of senior citizens have some immunity to it. So it must be sort of like something that's been here a long time ago. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. We're going to rock and roll right after this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman, and it's always a joy to have him on the show with us. Stanton Friedman is, for those of you who are new to the show, Stanton Friedman is a nuclear physicist. He is a UFO investigator, par excellence, I might add. He is an author. He is a lecturer. And probably a few other things that I don't even know about. Stanton, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Glad to be on again. One of the things I am, incidentally, is a columnist for the MUFON Journal, Mutual UFO Network Monthly Journal, and for UFO Magazine. So I'm keeping busy.
Yes, you are. Speaking of keeping busy, you've just returned from the conference out in Roswell. Tell us a little bit about what happened this year.
Well, I'll tell you, I spent almost all my time at the International UFO Museum and Research Center. There was this sort of competing program up at the Roswell Civic Center, and usually I'm able to get away to get up there, see old friends, see what's going on, get some idea of the interest levels and stuff, but this year I was so busy at the museum, I didn't. I gave four lectures. I foolishly, a few years back when I was asked for some lecture titles, I thought they were going to pick one, you know, so I gave them four, and they picked off four. And that happened again this year, and I was also, there was a fine panel one night, 2 hours, with Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, whose book Witness to Roswell is kind of a breakthrough book this year. It's an update on the same title last year. And Dr. David Rudiak. Now, some of your listeners may recall that on the Sci-Fi Channel back a few years ago, Dr. Rudiak was the one who used a number of clever techniques to try to figure out what's in the Ramey memo. General Ramey, in his office, is holding a piece of paper in his hand on July 8, 1947. He's with, some of the pictures, then-Colonel Thomas Jefferson Dubose. And there's some balloon wreckage in front of them. It certainly had nothing to do with Roswell, but it looked impressive. Anyway, the question is, can you read the print on the memo he's holding in his hand? And the other pictures, it's faced away from the camera. Now, I should stress, for those of you who are into digital photography, you could never read it if it had been taken with a digital camera. But this was taken with a 4x5 speed graphic. The negative is actually 4 inches by 5 inches.
So it's very high resolution.
Yeah, and even though the picture was taken from at least 10 feet away, when you blow it up, I've had scans done of the original negative in Texas. And David managed to read it using both trying to figure out the individual letters, and there's some software that's available now where you can put in letters for spaces 1, 3, 6, 8, 9, and then find out what words there are in English that could be. And one of the interesting words is victims of the wreck, and the only other word would be violins. Or virgins, I guess, and neither one of them seem appropriate for the circumstances. So this panel of the four of us went well, and a new witness was introduced, one of the people who was on one of the flights that left Roswell with this big crate of stuff in it for Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And he was introduced, his son was there with him, and last year we had a new witness, also who picked up wreckage. So the museum was busy, lots of people going through, weather was nice, missed the parade because it was at the same time as the panel. There were other speakers, some of whom came down to the museum, and I was glad to see Dr. Jesse Marcel, son of Major Marcel. And the doctor is the co-author with his wife of recollections, not recollections, he's in that too, but of the Roswell legacy. And he's a very special guy. It's no wonder when the Peter Jennings mockumentary was on, they didn't bother to mention that, oh, he's just a colonel in the Army Air Force. He is a medical doctor, a flight surgeon, flew 225 combat hours in helicopter during the Iraq War, starting at age 68, I might add. One might think that those go to credibility a little bit. Anyway,
you would think so, yeah.
And there were other speakers there. So now I can't say how big the overall crowd in town. I know that the hotels were all booked. Say that. And so I enjoyed myself and signed an awful lot of books for people, which is nice. And in today's world, and I mentioned digital pictures, now what happens is everybody who comes along, can I have your picture taken with me? I felt like a model, for goodness sake.
Well, you know, you're one of those famous people, you know, you're a celebrity.
Well, everybody tells me, I keep seeing you on the History Channel and the other channels, and I say, I didn't see you. I'm in your living room. I guess they want their picture taken with me because I'm in their living room. Maybe they got nothing else to do. I don't know, but it's funny, you know. When I first started going to conventions, nobody asked to have their picture taken with you because we didn't have digital cameras. So now everybody pulls one out of their pockets, and at least, you know, one of the advantages of being there is you get to put your arm around all the lovely ladies who come to these things. You know?
Yeah, well, and, you know, that can get you in trouble if your wife is the jealous type, you know, but...
Well, I hope
still,
nobody sends the pictures to my wife.
Oh, mercy. Well, you've got another conference coming up, don't you?
What?
You have another conference coming up in a couple of weeks, right?
This is quite different now. This will be the Mutual UFO Network 40th Anniversary International Symposium. 40 years is a long time in the UFO business. I've only been lecturing for, 42 years, so. This will be in Denver, and it's a full program, you know, in honor of the anniversary. I mean, it's always a full program, but one of the nice things about the MUFON conferences, and I'm the first speaker on Friday night, August the 7th, all day, the 8th and the 9th, there will be speakers and an anniversary dinner and stuff like that. There will be vendors and a lot of good speakers, people like Dr. Bruce McAbee, for example, is going to talk about 35 years of looking at UFO pictures. He's an optical physicist. Dr. Rudiak, that I mentioned before, is an optometrist, so we got guys who know about eyes. Ted Phillips is going to be there. Now, I keep hearing all these nasty, noisy negativists saying, there is no physical evidence. Well, Ted has collected well over 3,000 physical trace cases from, 90 countries. These are cases where people see the saucer on or near the ground, often seeing it land and take off, and where after it leaves, one finds physical changes, the equivalent of burn circles, burn rings, landing gear marks. These are not crop circles now. These aren't beautiful. But they're clearly evidence of something having been there. And tests have been done on samples of the dirt and nearby control samples. And the dirt, sometimes it's dried out down 14 inches in a circle 10 feet in outer diameter, a foot across. It won't absorb moisture compared to the nearby control samples. So the physical trace cases are very important. About a sixth involve reports of beings, creatures, critters, humanoids, whatever you want to call them, associated with the craft. And so these are very important cases, and it's amazing how the nasty, noisy negativists never talk about the physical trace cases. There is no physical evidence. That's their mantra. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what you call radar film of radar screens, transcripts of radio conversations with pilots who are watching the UFO and with the guys on the ground watching the whole thing on radar. And
or even record.
That's physical evidence.
Sometimes you have voice recordings of that, too.
Say that again?
Sometimes you have voice recordings of those conversations as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, plenty of times. And so, you know, I get a kick. You know, I'm on a kick against the nasty, noisy negativists because they stand in the way of truth, science, reality. And it's amazing, the current issue, July issue of Scientific American, has another debunking article by Michael Shermer. He's head of the Skeptics Society and edits their magazine. He does have a PhD in the history of science, never worked as a scientist, but got a good business going in the skeptic business.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a monthly column in Scientific American, and he bemoans the lack of evidence and says we need evidence to make judgments on, but he never looks at the evidence. Now, he mentions the Larry King show that was on a couple years back that he was on. I was on the same show. What he doesn't mention is that 2 weeks later, we did a debate on Coast to Coast Radio, and I got 80% of the vote for the simple reason he didn't know anything about the subject, and he hadn't done any homework. He hadn't looked at the evidence. 80% is a pretty strong victory in this field.
Well, it is, and but that's one of the big, big problems. Not what it's not true. What I'm about to say is not true of all so-called skeptics. But one of the big problems with a great many of them is they do not look at the evidence. They haven't read the pertinent reports. They haven't looked at the pertinent documents. They haven't read the scientific analyses of the various trace evidence, and basically they're shooting from the lip.
Very well put. And, you know, I was just, I'm working on another book, book number 5. I'm the Grandma Moses of the UFO book business, starting late, but we're still going at it. And I've been looking at stuff that was written by my University of Chicago classmate for 3 years, Carl Sagan. And over again, he made statements that were simply untrue. And in Demon-Haunted World, his most commonly referenced source for UFO information was Weekly World News, a tabloid. No mention of the 5 large-scale scientific studies that I talk about. No mention of a dozen PhD theses. Now, this isn't science. Well,
let me ask you, because, look, you're a scientist, so let me ask you, why does it seem like scientists, so-called scientists, credentialed scientists, are so nervous about the topic of UFOs that they run from any evidence? Why is that?
You know, I'm not a psychiatrist, and as I often tell people when they ask me why questions, you know, a lot of things in the world I don't understand. Priests who attack 10-year-old boys, adult males who attack 3-year-old girls, serial killers, etc. But, I mean, the question is whether it's happening or not, whether we understand why. But my own feeling, and that's all it is from my interaction with, you know, 700 lectures, so I do occasionally, at 600 of them at colleges, I do occasionally run into scientists, is that they're very arrogant and ignorant at the same time. They take great pride in knowing what's important in the world. And they all admit if aliens were visiting, that would be important. But if it were important, they would know about it, and they don't, so it must not be. And they're not going to waste their time on a nothing subject. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Don't waste your time. Don't look at the evidence. And they won't find any evidence. And, you know, they can move on with their head held high. And, you know, one of the differences, I worked in industry. I mean, I've spoken at 600 colleges, but I worked at little companies like GE, GM, Westinghouse, that sort of thing. And we weren't in the publisher-perish business. Our job performance was based on what we did. Did we get the experiments done on time? Did we meet our targets this way or that way? not how many papers we could get out of it. Accomplishment was the goal. And that's very different. I didn't need to publish or perish. Oh, I gave papers even at classified meetings when I was in industry. And I certainly wrote technical reports, but, you know, mostly internal because most of them were classified. But I found the general run of college professors, A, know nothing about how industry works. They know nothing about how the government works. They can't imagine that somebody would be involved, for example, in something as important as examining material from a crashed saucer and not publish papers right away all about it. They don't understand national security. After all, the first country to duplicate the behavior of flying saucers is going to rule the planet. They also can't conceive of huge projects. Typical college research project might involve, a big one would involve maybe a dozen professors and 40 grad students. That would be a huge project. Well, you know, you go into industry, stealth fighter program spent 10 years and $10 billion in secret. No publications in the open scientific literature.
And by the way, let me just inject, that aircraft will do things that prior to that aircraft, everyone would have sworn were impossible.
That's right. And, you know, especially including the academics.
Mm-hmm.
And I get so many arguments that seem to assume that the details don't matter. We know it would take too much energy to go to another star system. It would take too long without looking at the details. And what I've tried to do, there's a chapter in my book, Flying Saucers and Science, about you can get here from there. And I point out that one of the calculations done by a professor of astronomy in 1941 was, how big a rocket would you need to get a man to the moon and back? Now, that's a legitimate question. Pages of equations, the conclusion was absurd. It would have to weigh 1 million tons. But he made all the wrong assumptions about how you go about doing it, some of them without even mentioning what they were. He assumed a single-stage rocket launched straight up, no external sources of energy like the rotation of the Earth, the gravitational field of the Moon, much too low in acceleration, much too low in exhaust velocity. The Saturn V weighed 3,000 tons. He was off by a factor of 300 million because the devil is in the details. And they just don't seem to understand that. And you know, I give as an example from my own experience, because I know about that at least, when I was working on nuclear airplanes, and I've said this before in your show, but back in 1958, General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, this wasn't a little UFO group off in the corner, we spent $100 million that year and employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. $100 million was a lot of money in 1958.
Yeah.
And they can't conceive of something like that going on. The data was classified. I gave papers at classified radiation shielding meetings, would you believe? And after the program was finished, I gave some at meetings of the American Nuclear Society because things have been more or less declassified. But so that's one of the reasons. They don't want to admit ignorance. They do want to act as if they're on top of the world. They don't want to be associated with the fringe groups, the kook groups.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be on the safe side, people used to tell J. Allen Hynek, well, I'll look at that stuff, but don't tell anybody. Worrying about their reputation instead of being concerned with getting new information about the world around us. And so it's a complicated business, but
Stanton, I hate to break in, but we have to take a break. We're going to step away for a couple of minutes. We'll be back right after this, folks, with more of Stanton Friedman. welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Stanton Friedman. And let me just quickly say, because I need to do this, all of the music you hear on this show comes from the independent artist at garageband.com or music.podshow.com. None of that commercial stuff for us. We're going to steer clear of the tsunami that is about to wipe out a lot of independent broadcasters. Stanton, when we went away, you were talking about how this mindset exists in the scientific community where they're just nervous about looking at the evidence. Well, that's one of the things that I've always really appreciated about your work is that you do very meticulous research and then you document your research. And I want to bring up something. Now, I've got to make a little statement in the beginning of this before we get into it. One of the big blow-ups right now among the UFO community is the ongoing battle between Robert Hastings and Robert Collins
and
Rick Doty, yeah. And I've had Robert Collins on the show, and I've had Robert Hastings on the show. And once this battle kicked off, I have made a decision that me and this show will stay out. Actually, I should say I and this show will stay out of that war of words. And I'm going to continue that, and I have no intention of dragging you into this or into that battle between those gentlemen. But laying aside their battle of words, there is one topic over which they battle that you have researched extensively and you have written about extensively, and that is, and by the way, before this battle broke out, you had written about it. That is the topic of the MJ-12 documents. And I'd like to sort of get into that a little bit because I do get email from people who ask, what do you think? Are the MJ documents real? Are they not real? And generally at this point in time, those emails are coming from people who are sort of following that war of words as it takes place on the internet. So, like I said, I'm not asking you to referee their fight, nor am I wanting for us to get into that battle. But the topic of the MJ-12 documents, let's get into that. What about those documents? Is there any reality to any of those documents?
Well, yeah, I mean, that the first thing one has to do is to deal with documents on their own, not stir them all into the same pot and act as if they all are of equal value or legitimacy or anything like that. And I was very pleased that Robert Hastings and I got a chance to talk to each other down in Curitiba, Brazil, last month. That most people were speaking Portuguese, and neither one of us does, so we had more chance than you might expect to talk about these. And we came away with more respect for each of us. I really appreciate, as a nuclear guy, the fact that he's collected so much information about nukes and UFOs. But I stress to him that my position on these documents has nothing to do with Collins or Doty. That's the first thing. Second thing, I spent an awful lot of time at 20 archives looking at documents. I worked under security for 14 years, so I'm pretty familiar with documents as such, classified documents. And I would certainly say that the great majority of MJ-12 documents are phony. You know, just like the great majority of isotopes aren't fissionable. The great majority of people aren't 7 feet tall, which has nothing to do with the fact that there are a few isotopes that are fissionable and there are some few seven-footers around.
Yeah.
And so I separate the documents into the original two, if you will, the Eisenhower briefing document and the Truman Forrestal memo, which was page 8 on that. And the third one, the Cutler-Twining memo, which was found at the National Archives. And they, I say those are genuine. Okay, there's over 100 pages that have come through Tim Cooper, who is now himself saying that they're all baloney, but he doesn't say why the ones that didn't come through him are all baloney. And I give good reasons why a whole bunch of those must be considered baloney. I found 7, for example, were emulations of documents published in books. You retype them, scan, or Xerox, I suppose, the handwritten stuff, put them together, and you got a genuine-looking document. There really is the guy's signature. But they're phony as soon as you put one alongside the other. Now, I've done that in Top Secret Magic, the second edition. And so I would certainly agree. If anybody says most of those documents are garbage, I'd say, yay, verily. I agree wholeheartedly for these reasons. Here's what's wrong with these documents. That doesn't mean that SOM 101, for example, which came from a different source than the others, is phony. And it certainly doesn't mean that the original Eisenhower briefing document, Truman Forrestal memo, and Cutler-Twining memo are phony. And my point is, let's look at the facts. If you've got an objection to the documents, the four that I mentioned, then let me know and make sure it isn't one that I've already covered in Top Secret Magic. Or if you go to my website at www.stantonfriedman.com, I have a review of a book, Case MJ-12, by Dr. Kevin Randall. And I point out a whole bunch of things wrong in the book. So you can read what I have to say. They're specific things. They're not generalities. Oh, those documents are obvious nonsense. That's a meaningless kind of thing. And what I find is that, yes, most documents are phony, and most people who say they're all phony haven't looked carefully at the work that's been done. They tend to forget that Phil Klass paid me $1,000, for example, for proving him wrong on the typeface on the Cutler-Twining memo. Now, we didn't have a bet. He made an offer. He'd give me $100 each for every genuine memo, and he had a whole bunch of criteria, done in the same size and style type. It's the large pica type instead of the small elite type. He'd give me $100 each, up, unfortunately, to a limit of 10. I wish he hadn't put in the limit, because then I'd have made a lot of money. Anyway, I sent him 14 after going to the Eisenhower Library again. I've been there many times. He'd never been there. That's an interesting contrast, isn't it? And I already had documents done in the large pica type. But he told everybody about challenging me, but then nobody about paying me. I'll give him credit for paying me. He kept his word. But it would have been nice if he had admitted to the world that he was totally wrong about these the typeface.
And we need to emphasize for the audience what you're talking about are documents that were produced at a time when it was all done on typewriters.
Yeah. I know some people don't know what typewriters are, but these are in the early 50s or late 40s. And so, yeah, we don't need to worry about what computer was it typed with. And people also forget that since this work was classified and there was no Freedom of Information Act, there was certainly no expectation that these documents would be seen by the public. And so who cared? And, you know, one of the objections to the Eisenhower briefing document is that the date format is 18 November, 1952. And the guy with 3 degrees in English, Joe Nickel from the Skeptics Group, Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, I call it CSI Light, you know, that he doesn't get involved in these things. He doesn't look at the data. And he said that these were obviously frauds because of that comma in the date format. Now, when you go to the darn archives, you find at that first papers at that time. I mean, the Eisenhower Library alone has 250,000 pages of classified material, still classified. You got a total of about 300,000 of National Security Council material. And there are all kinds of date formats. It depended on who typed it. I put out a report way back in 1990 for the Fund for UFO Research, still available on the website, Final Report on Operation Majestic 12. I got a research grant, so I had to write a report. And I gave, for example, 3 letters from the Director of Central Intelligence to President Eisenhower's staff secretary, at that time Colonel and then later General Goodpaster. 3 letters written within 2 weeks, 3 different date formats.
And there's you are exactly right. Anyway. It does depend on who's typing it. In my former capacity in international police, and even before that when I was working in police work here in the United States, I was responsible for producing various documents and briefings and so forth. And I had people that worked with me and under me that would actually be typing these things. And depending on who typed them, I could tell by looking at the typos within a document which one of them typed it. You know, after a while, you there are patterns that you notice. But depending on who types it, you're going to get the American date format, or you're going to get the international date format, or variations thereof, and it just depends on who actually produces the document.
Yeah, and there seems to be no recognition of that, so people do their research by proclamation. The date format is wrong. That security marking, top secret restricted, was not in use. Fortunately, the General Accounting Office found examples of it and said so in a document they put out. Of course, nobody else refers to that. And there's a whole bunch of these sort of trivial things that I have checked on. And I have a long list of things that you have to ask, how did somebody know that to be true at that time when we didn't find it out until much time after getting the document? And so, you know, that's kind of important. When things are published, you know, later, well, as an example, I found that one of the documents says that General Twining was supposedly instructed to go to New Mexico. This is one of the phony documents.
Stanton, we're almost at a break, and I want people to hear this. You told me this, okay. And I want people to hear this story. This is good. All right, folks, we have to step away for a couple of minutes here for a break, and then we will be back. We're going to hear that story, and then we're also going to get back into one specific MJ-12 document that Stanton mentioned. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. And Stanton, you were just about to tell us that story about the document fraud that took place.
Well, yeah, there was, I'll go back a little bit. One of the documents from Tim Cooper, who flunked the polygraph examination and has now said all the documents are phony. He won't admit that he wouldn't take another polygraph and so forth. But one of the documents that came through him was a one that mentioned that General Albert Wiedemeyer signed off on something. And I'd been to the Marshall Archives, and Wiedemeyer was a China expert who Marshall sent to China in that very tough period of 1947, when Mao Zedong was moving in, you know, and Chiang Kai-shek was having troubles. It was a crucial thing. Marshall had spent months, George C. Marshall, who was chief of staff for the United States government during all of World War II, and whom Truman considered the outstanding living American at that time. Marshall had sent Wiedemeyer to China with a bunch of people to try to make an evaluation of where do we go from here, what should be done, what happens if we don't support them militarily, etc. And so I called the Marshall Archives and said, I don't understand why Wiedemeyer's name is on here. The other guys, there are 12 guys named for MJ-12, you could make sense out of those, scientists, engineers, etc. But Wiedemeyer, a China expert, what do you need him for on a UFO thing? Anyway, he said, I don't understand that either, Stan. I can't see any reason for him to be on that. Why don't you check his book, Wiedemeyer Reports? Well, I hadn't even known that Wiedemeyer had written a book, but I called the University of New Brunswick Library, which is about a mile and a half from the house. They had the book. I went over and got it. And looking through it, within 10 minutes, I found three documents that clearly had been emulated, that is, retyped with the handwritten stuff copied in some way. And one of them was this supposed, the original, was the directive written to Wiedemeyer on July 9th, 1947, an approved, handwritten approval from Harry Truman, and with the date of July 9th, 2009. So we have a signature, I approve, and a date. And when I looked at the memo that had come through Tim Cooper, is supposedly a directive to General Twining to go to New Mexico to look at a crashed saucer, it's clear that almost all the words are identical, not just similar, but identical. But there's also a little mistake. In the directive to Wiedemeyer, it says, when you're finished in China, go to Korea, which obviously is not part of China. To Twining, it says, when you're finished in New Mexico, go to Sandia. But Sandia Labs, that's one of the three nuclear weapons labs, is in New Mexico. So that makes no sense. Now, furthermore, I got, by accident, really, a copy of General Twining's flight log. It was in a box that I had asked to have declassified long before. Finally, it was, and I was going at the National at the Library of Congress Manuscript Division, which has 120 boxes of his papers. And originally, a great many of them were classified, and I kept whittling away at them. Anyway, I'm back there, and son of a gun, here's a newly declassified box, and at the back of it is Twining's flight log. I can prove that he didn't go to New Mexico on the 9th, he went on the 7th, which just happens to be the date that's given in the Eisenhower briefing document, as that's when the investigation began. Now, I talked to his daughter, General Twining's daughter. I tried to talk to families of all of the members of this Majestic 12 group, and I missed one. But the others I managed to find with General Twining. I talked to both his sons and his daughter. His daughter was the one who gave me the name of his pilot and got his flight log, and the two matched. Now, nobody had that information beforehand. How did somebody know to get it right, in other words? And so I had a lot of that stuff. Talking to the pilot was useful because he was with Twining on most of his trips, and he gave me insights as to who he saw and all that sort of thing, and how Twining liked to do certain things and so forth. And so I can't find anybody else who goes looking for families and talks to people and dug out people like pilots. I mean, I talked to General Ramey's first and second wife and his brother and his son. One of the more interesting people in this document to illustrate the lengths to which people will go is Admiral, Director of Central Intelligence, Roscoe H. Hillencoder. Now, in the briefing document, he's listed as Admiral Hillencoder. And some people have immediately said, he wasn't an admiral, he was a rear admiral. Obviously, the document is fraudulent. That sounds like a good argument until you realize that all the military titles are generic ranks. That is, general covers brigadier, lieutenant, major, four-star, etc. Admiral covers rear admiral and full admiral, and there's another one in there someplace.
Listen, I have dealt with military when I was overseas. I've been on U.S. military bases. Many of the bases, a good number of the bases I've been to, were under the command of a lieutenant colonel, and I have yet to hear anyone refer to him, to his face, as lieutenant colonel. They say colonel.
Yes, right on. Exactly the same thing. And so here are these people making a big deal in that book, the Operation MJ-12. This is a big story, you see. He wasn't an admiral. But I've got the Truman Library listings of his attendance at meetings and stuff like that. And sometimes he's called admiral. Sometimes he's called rear admiral. And when I was at the Eisenhower Library, and the only way you can do this is pretty much to go to the places to look through this stuff, I found a whole bunch of memcons, memos of conversation, written by Ike's staff secretary. By this time, he was General Goodpaster. And he would list the people attending meetings at the White House. He'd write notes up, in other words, so that he could keep track of who agreed to do what, when, for whom. You know, this is standard practice, and much of this was classified. He'd list at the beginning the attendees at the meeting, and he would always use generic ranks. He wouldn't say lieutenant general, he'd say general. And he even called himself general, but he signed it brigadier general. And because I was at the library, they have a big fat book that lists all the officers that ever had anything to do with anything, and you could look up the name and find out what rank they were. I recognized some of the names, but I certainly didn't recognize them all. I'm not that old. And I found that generic ranks were the way these things were done. And I asked two different archivists independently. I said, does this bother you that he called him admiral, let's say, when he was really only a rear admiral? Well, that's normal. That's standard. And I looked in one of Ike's book, and he does that himself. So here we have people making a real big fuss about something, which if they'd done their homework on, wasn't fussable about. It was standard practice to use generic ranks, not to sign them that way, but when you're listing people, standard practice. And that's one of many such things that I found. When you go to the people who know. Another one, there was a long complaint, loud and long complaint, that none of these documents have top secret control numbers on them. Obviously, they're fraudulent because every single top secret document has to have a control number. Well, I'd already published a couple that I knew were genuine because I got them at archives, that didn't have control numbers. So again, I checked with the archivist, and the guy at the Marshall Archives said, Stan, if every document had to have a control number, we'd still be fighting World War II. And when I talked to the man at the Eisenhower Library, he said, and he put it in writing, We have many top secret documents that do not have control numbers. Now,
all right, we have to step away, Stanton, for a break, and we'll be back. When we come back, we'll finish that up, and I want to get back into the SOM document. We'll be back, folks, right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And my guest this evening, Stanton Friedman, nuclear physicist, columnist, lecturer, author, and now he's made it to the big time. He's on the Kevin Smith Show again. I couldn't help it.
Why not?
Things like that just get into me sometimes. Stanton, I had to cut you off. And I want you to be able to finish your thought.
Yeah, about top secret control numbers. Uh-huh. One guy wrote a strong thing on a UFO updates chat group that record group 341 is all top secret documents, and they all have top secret control numbers, and Friedman doesn't tell you that. Well, I responded immediately because I have the listing of all the folders in record group 341. It's 50 pages or something. It's huge. Anyway, I pointed out that in the first place, most of the documents are not top secret. Only a small percentage are. And you can tell that, for example, when they'll say messages, headquarters, and this time frame, it'll say confidential and secret, 1,000 pages, top secret, 30 pages. And so you have a pretty good handle real quick. And so I responded very strongly about that. And he responded after 4 days saying, I must apologize. My source has not responded to me. And so I'm not going to be on this UFO updates anymore. There's nobody here I want to deal with. I'm going to take my marbles and go home is what it sounded like. But, you know, here I have a statement from an archivist at the Eisenhower Library and another one at the Marshall Archives that they have plenty of top secret documents that don't have control numbers. Now, I should stress, for those who wonder about such things, there's an enormous difference between a document that you have copy one of one, eyes only, one of one, and one that is a 20-page document that goes to 20 different people. You have to keep track of the latter because for, bookkeeping purposes, you have to know where your documents are. But if it goes from General A to General B, they just assume not use control numbers, which is an extra step in paperwork and signing off and so forth. So I'm not saying they're never used. Of course not. But
they're not always used. They're not always used. That's the point.
They're not always used. That's the point. One white crow proves not all crows are black. So he made a big fuss about this, and he was totally wrong, which he could have found out if he had checked some. But he knew his experience. He had handled lots of documents. There's another thing. Some people think that all government agencies behave exactly the same. It's simply not true. At least back then it wasn't.
Well, here's another thing about that. If every let's say for a moment that I am that guy, okay? And let's say that I'm claiming I've handled lots of documents and they all had those control numbers. What that means is that I did have the clearance to see those documents, but I was very low on the totem pole. Because the documents that don't have control numbers are documents where you're going, as you say, from principle to principle.
Yeah.
So if all the documents I see have control numbers, okay, I have clearance to see them, but I am low in the pecking order. That's why there's a control number.
That's a very good point. I hadn't even thought of that. I appreciate that. I'll use that argument next time somebody brings that one up.
But well, I happen to know about that. That's how that works.
We're talking, we're talking on the one hand trivia. On the other hand, if you're going to attack a document, you better give me something substantial. And none of these guys have. So my point, again, is not to say all the MJ-12 documents are genuine, because they're not.
But you said the first two that were released were genuine.
Yes.
And then after that, there was a flood of fraudulent ones.
Yes.
Okay, now here's another thing that I think people need to think about. Now, I've talked about this before. I've had Walter Bosley on the show. He is a former special agent with Air Force OSI. And he is a counterintelligence expert. And we've talked about this very thing on this show, and I want to highlight it in this case. Let's say that all of a sudden some document gets out that it gets leaked out. It's genuine, and it's a real bombshell, and people are talking about it, and it falls under my command to get this thing quietened down. The best thing to do to make it go away is to have a whole bunch of additional information that's fantastic and that's just, boy, it's the greatest stuff on earth. Have that information get out there, but it's all fake. It's been doctored. So I release all of that. So now when it gets kicked out of the carriage, that real document is assumed to be fake, and it gets kicked out of the carriage too. That's the best way to counter the real stuff, is to inject a bunch of fake stuff, because
I'm so glad to hear you say that.
Well, we know that it's a human tendency to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yep.
And so that's what happens. All right, let's talk about this SOM document for a minute. What is it? SOM 101?
1.01. Special Operating Manual.
Mm-hmm.
And that came from Wisconsin. The Eisenhower briefing document and the Truman Parcel memo came from Albuquerque. And it was, again, in the form of a roll of film. And I heard about it inadvertently because Don Berliner, with whom I had written the book Crash at Corona, we were having a conversation, and he mentioned something about the other MJ-12 document. I said, Don, wait a minute, what is this? Well, he hemmed and hawed, and I said, hey, I need to know. I'm getting involved in these discussions. Well, finally he admitted, this is like November, that in March he'd gotten a roll of film from Oshkosh, which he had been to for a conference on people make their own airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sophisticated conference. And he had gotten a roll of film sent from there, and he thought, oh, must be the last roll of film that I processed or something or other. He opened it, he had it processed, thinking it was airplanes and stuff. And it wasn't. It was SOM 101. Well, he had a quickie print made when he realized that it wasn't what he thought it was. And so he sent me a crude copy of it, and I said, gee, that's interesting. This is supposedly in the early 50s, and it's instructions for military people how to handle recovery of a crashed saucer, of bodies, of other stuff, cover stories to use for the press, and, you know, how do you package it, trivia. And a number of people who've looked at it said, gee, that's the way government documents are. And what he didn't do, though, was print all the pages, and that included the change page. In something like a manual, you normally update it. So you mm-hmm. replace page 8 with a new page 8, and you list it in the back as what date you did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he didn't do that. He didn't include that. And when I got this rough copy he sent me, I said, gee whiz, I need somebody to look at this who's had a lot more experience with top secret stuff. My stuff was mostly Q, top secret restricted data, nuclear stuff. So I suggested I'd sure like to have Dr. Robert M. Wood look at that. He was director of research for McDonnell Douglas Astronautics, worked on a whole host of classified programs, known him for a long time. We disagree about some of these MJ-12 documents, incidentally. But so Don Berliner sent Bob a set of these, and he did all kinds of sophisticated research. And then he also had all the pages printed, taking them to a very good quality photography place. And one of my objections had been that, boy, these aren't good quality pictures. And the thing that impressed me about the original Eisenhower briefing document, the Truman Forrestal memo, was that whoever took those pictures, they came as negatives, two sets of eight negatives each, knew what he was doing. They're very sharp when you get prints made from these negatives. And so Bob did all kinds of work, and I'm convinced one of the key things, I'm convinced that the document's almost certainly real. One of the key things is he found that it was done in monotype, and that's not what people use anymore around. They use linotype. And I didn't realize that an expert in this sort of thing can tell the difference just by looking at them. How the spacing between the letters is determined. Kerning, that's the word.
Mm-hmm.
Word I'd never heard before.
Mm-hmm.
But when I've talked to a couple of experts, they said, oh, yes, Stan, everybody knows that. Well, I didn't know that. But I wasn't posing as an expert on typefaces and stuff. So that's one of the reasons. Plus, when this change page, one of the objections had been that it talks about a cover story being a satellite, tell the press. Satellite had come down. But this was 54. And we didn't put up, the first satellite wasn't put up until 57.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a fraud, until you realize that you can find all kinds of references. We were all talking about satellites well before that, including the government. And the change page indicated that the replacement page was actually much later than 54, a couple of years later. So I find it an intriguing document. I've had several people tell me, former military guys who were accustomed to handling manual, it's an operating manual after all, that the terminology, the language, the whole approach was typical, standard, normal military. That plus the monotype makes me lean very heavily on that, because people don't have monotype machines in their basement. And Bob talked to people at the government printing office, people like that, who are experts at document preparation for the government,
mm-hmm.
and got good information back. So I'll give that a 99.9. The other ones I'll give a 99.9999. Okay.
Good enough.
And then there's some I'll give a 0.001.
All right. What I'd like to do is open up the telephone line.
Sure.
And allow folks in our audience to call in if they have a question or a comment. The telephone numbers to use, ladies and gentlemen, are 623-444-5889. Or if you need to use our toll-free number, it is 888-223-4599. If you live outside of the USA and Canada, those numbers will work, but they're not toll-free. So if you live outside the USA and you live outside of Canada and you would like to participate in tonight's show, send me a flash message. You go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and click on the link down below Stanton's photograph that says flash message. And by the way, as always, if you click on his photograph, it'll take you to his website. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello there. Hello, Kevin. Hello, Stanton. How are you doing?
Hi.
Stanton, I've got two questions. One, about the MJ-12 documents and whether they're fake or not. Are there so many documents that you're still unsure of?
No, I would say, except for the ones that I've said are okay, I think all the rest I would very strongly be tempted to say are phony. There's a whole bunch in the same kind of techniques. And also, I guess I'd have to put some in my gray basket that is not sure, because I got nothing to compare them to. But there's some from President Kennedy that I think are what somebody wants to hear. They sound impressive, but I think Kevin covered that. You put out junk. And so I want to go with the stuff that I can feel certain about, and that's exciting enough, believe me.
My second question is, how do you feel the military-industrial complex, some people like to call them the Illuminati, the global elite, whatnot, what role do you think they've played in the suppression of UFO data, even to this day?
I don't know that they've played any, although it should be perfectly obvious, and people don't want to think this way, but they have to, that all nations have some of the same concerns about alien visitations. And they don't need to conspire. You know, people seem to think that if the United States and Russia, one would say during the Cold War we were enemies all the time and so forth. Now, the Russians didn't tell their people about the U-2 flights over the Soviet Union. The Americans didn't tell their people about U-2 flights over the Soviet Union. Did they get together and say, we're not going to talk about this? No. We didn't tell anybody because we were violating international law. The Russians didn't tell anybody because they couldn't admit that they couldn't do anything about the flights. But you notice when Gary Power's plane got shot down, now the Russians had protested quietly to the United States through diplomatic channels, but once the plane got shot down, they made big noise, and we lied, you know, just blown off course and all that sort of thing. And finally, Eisenhower, to his credit, after Khrushchev showed the camera and Powers and all of that, Ike admitted we were spying on the Soviet Union because they're a closed society and we needed to know what was going on there. We couldn't have another Pearl Harbor kind of thing. So, you know, where the international... when I say that they have common goals of not wanting people to know, I know of no country on this planet that wants its citizens to owe their primary allegiance to the planet instead of that individual country. Nationalism's the only game in town. If we suddenly say that aliens are visiting, then we're faced with a couple of questions. Who speaks for planet Earth? Who negotiates? I mean, the United Nations doesn't let cities in. I can't imagine the Galactic Federation letting countries in as opposed to planets. Surely most of the places out there who are a little bit more advanced than we are, say 100 or 1,000 years, no less a million, will recognize that planet is the unit that we're talking about here. So people in power share a common desire not to give up power. That certainly applies on the international level in those groups that you mentioned. Call them the Illuminati and the other ones, the Trilateral Commission, and, you know, all these other things.
Yeah, they're all about sucking up more power. There's not a bone in them that wants to give up power.
And, you know, people say, well, we'll hold an election. Well, come on. The United States has 305 million people. Russia and China and India between them have 2.3 billion people. We're not going to have a one-vote, one-person election.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And so there are legitimate concerns. Also, the religious angle here, even though the Pope has sort of given his blessing, if I can put it that way, that it's okay for there to be aliens out there. But there are some real implications. For example, what if they've been stealing goodies from us for years because we don't even know they're important? Who are they going to pay now? Who are they going to deal with? You know, that's a tricky question. And the kind of thing I'm talking about, it sounds trivial. Uranium, for example, 100 years ago was used as a yellow coloring agent for pottery that was used on dinner tables for plates and stuff. That's illegal now. But we didn't know that uranium had some other things that could be done with it, like nuclear reactors and nuclear bombs and stuff like that. How many other things have they been dealing with? Who's going to, you know, get the dough? What do we offer in return?
All of those are questions. Yeah, and all of those are questions that fall into the realm, or should fall into the realm, of the discussion now about exopolitics, which is a hair-raising kind of a subject in itself. All right, let's go back to the telephone caller. You are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Ryan in Washington State.
Hi, Ryan.
Stan, I was, first of all, Kevin, your video looks a lot better. It looks really great. I haven't had any problems so far tonight.
Good deal.
Stan, I was reading today that, the photographer by the name of Alan Grant, who is a very, very well-respected, famous photographer for Life magazine, he took the photograph of Oswald's wife standing next to him, and he had a real respected career. That apparently, the story is his wife is talking about how he was rushed out to Roswell at the time of the crash, and his boss said, "You need to get out there right now." And apparently, he met up with Major Charles Phillips, and to go out to the crash site. And according to his wife and according to him, they were going to...
Wasn't nothing there.
Yeah, looking for a meteor. Now, of course, that's not what they found, but he believes that he was used by them to so that the public would see that, look, Life magazine went there and nothing was there. I'm sure you already know about this, but the question I had was, I guess what I wanted to say was that shortly after that, is it true that Major Charles Phillips, became one of the first UFO investigators for the U.S. Air Force, along with astronaut La Paz?
Well, he wasn't an astronaut. He was a meteoriticist, Lincoln La Paz.
Shortly after Roswell,
great.
So I thought that was an interesting story I was reading today.
Yeah, okay. Well, what about that, Stanton?
I'm fascinated, too, and that was by Anthony Bregoglia. I don't know how you pronounce his name, Bregoglia. And he's done some. He's got a chapter in the new book by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, "Witness to Roswell," where he talks about Nightingale, the memory medal, and how Battelle Memorial Institute was doing a lot of work with memory medal. But there's reference to a report that nobody's been able to find, and I did some work with the Battelle Memorial Institute, and they would be one of the first places I'd say you'd go to if you had a secret project that needed very competent metallurgist on, because that was their bag. So he's right on that score, and so I want to check further on the story about Phillips and Grant, and maybe find some other people who knew Grant and stuff like that. I don't think they gave the exact location where he went, which I'm very curious about. You know, New Mexico's a big state, and it's easy to go someplace where there's nothing. There's a lot of land where there's nothing.
Yeah. Same here in Arizona and Nevada. Lots of desert. We have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this, folks. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stanton Friedman. Stanton, let me throw something at you. And oh, and by the way, folks, the telephone line is open. And if you'd like to give us a call and you have a question or a comment for Stanton Friedman, the telephone number is 623-444-5889 or toll-free at 888-223-4599. Let me throw something at you and get your response to this. Now, this is in response to, we got a flash message here from John in the United Kingdom. And he wants to know your response to this, and I'll throw something in it as well. But here's what he asked. Do you think that someday science will overtake religion as being the main belief? And what I want to throw into that mix is I contend that science in the main, and we're not talking about you know, the researchers in the labs necessarily, but in the main, science is a religion these days because it is a belief in spite of data.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. That's the kind of, there's a whole chapter in Flying Saucers and Science about the cult of SETI, S-E-T-I, silly effort to investigate, as everybody knows, I call it, instead of search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And I really get into that because there's a whole bunch of assumptions that are glibly, casually made, having no basis in fact. There's no science there. They claim that there's no evidence for UFOs. They never reference large-scale scientific studies. They never reference the physical trace cases, the blacked-out CIA documents, the whited-out NSA documents. I got 156 of those. If somebody wants, you can read one sentence per page. Very exciting. Anyway, it's a real problem because they're making claims, assuming all kinds of things. It's part of the same anti-technology attitude. You can't get here from there because look how long it would take to get to Andromeda. Who cares? I'm worried about Zeta Reticuli, 39 light years away, not 2 million light years away.
Well, and another thing, you know, SETI is looking for radio signals. Now, if these beings are traveling at or near the speed of light, a radio wave, well, look, if they're traveling faster than the speed of light, which we've never observed to be possible, but if they are, a radio wave would be outrun by their speed. And, well, you know, they're never going to get a radio signal from an ET.
They're assuming that the aliens are stuck at the same technology level we are. We've had serious radio communication for about 100 years. Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli are billion years older than the sun.
Well, I think if ET if they are as advanced as we suspect they are, they probably have developed ways to communicate, perhaps at the quantum level of instantaneous communication, and as opposed to speed of light communication. All right, let's go back to the telephone caller. You are live on the. Well, you were live, and you gave up, so you lost your spot. 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. The line was breaking up. I didn't get to finish my comment. Is it okay if I just finish up my comment? And then
if you make it real quick, we usually have one call per show, but go ahead.
Oh, Stan, I just wanted to say, next time you're on Larry King with Bill Nye, would you mind just making him look like a fool on national television for me?
I will do my darnest. I tried, I think, somewhat successfully the last time. At least some people told me that, although I got a strange response. People said, gee, Larry ought to have him on more often because he does such a lousy job of defending the anti-UFO crowd.
Yeah, just take the David Rudiak work of the Ramey Memo and national television and just say, here, look, there is physical evidence.
Well, Bill Nye didn't get any facts right. Remember, he thought that the Malmstrom Air Force Base thing, just a power failure. It's triply redundant power, for God's sakes. you know, he said Roswell was a skyhook balloon, none of which had flown at the time of Roswell, and it wasn't a spy balloon as he claimed it was. I mean, you know, just off the wall. And, oh, I loved his attack on, people say there's a cover-up. Well, look, here's a document. All that's blacked out is the person's name. That's a privacy issue. Fortunately, I had my book with me, and I could show him one of the CIA documents that all you can read is eight words. Everything else is blacked out. That's a UFO document.
All right, Ryan, thanks for the call. Yeah, I'm one of those people that thinks that Bill Nye is exactly the right guy for him to have on because of those very issues. He does such immense discredit to his positions by his immense ignorance of the data.
Yeah.
Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Yeah, that call before on hold you lost, that was me because it's breaking up, and I thought I'd try and get a better line, but this is still doing the same thing.
Go ahead.
Stanton, besides the historical value you know, of your research and stuff, you know, I don't want to belittle or take away from it, but are you trying to use that for disclosure? I mean, because today, you know, we got, you know, real-time people with real-time documentation and evidence and stuff ready to go to Congress, hundreds of people, you know, and, you know, they ain't paying attention to them. So, I mean, you know, what kind of luck, you know, do you think you are going to have, you know, getting anybody to pay attention to you?
I've got four books out there. People are reading them. At least they're buying them. I do my lectures. I gave four lectures at the museum in Roswell. They're all full house lectures. And I do lots of radio and television shows. So I'm doing the best I can. I'm not part of an organized movement other than MUFON, really, to try to get the data out there. Partly because, unlike some of the people in the Disclosure Project, I do not believe everything should be put out on the table. Secrecy has a legitimate role here.
Well, and there's also this. If what people, Terry, if what people are looking for, and I don't know if this is kind of what you're looking for, but if what people are looking for is arrival at a date where the masses believe, consider that Judaism, Islam, Christianity, Zoroastrianism, and Buddhism have been around for millennia. They haven't gotten the masses to believe yet. The majority of the planet still doesn't buy their story. So there's not going to be a point at which there is a great conversion of people believing the evidence. You just get a preponderance of evidence and hope you get a preponderance of public opinion.
Right.
Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Trey in Louisiana.
Been a while, Trey.
Hi. Good. Thanks for coming on, Mr. Freeman. Good to talk to you again, Kevin. I didn't really have a question, Mr. Freeman. I just wanted to make a point of something y'all were talking about earlier. And you're talking about having a legitimate fact or investigation or point about a sighting, and then having someone else throw a bunch of silly stuff up around it to make it look ridiculous itself. Mm-hmm. Also, and one that came to mind was the not the Kecksburg, but the Rendlesham deal, where I think it was a year and a half or 2 years later, you had some guy who no one even remembered being there, all of a sudden talking about a spaceship landing and aliens getting out of it and coming out and all this and that. And, you know, it was funny that no one remembered him, and that's what that kind of reminded me of that, which you were talking about earlier, Kevin.
Well, I'm not familiar with that guy. Now, we had a guy on the show here who was there, and
Larry Warren?
No, well, we've had Warren. We've also had Peniston.
Peniston, Yeah.
And he had in his notebook his sketches from the time, and it's verified that he was there. Now, he doesn't say that he saw an alien, but what he says is that he saw the ship and or the craft and that he touched it.
Yeah.
And
I'm talking about the guy who, like a couple of years later, was talking about that no one remembers seeing. Even your guest that you were just talking about doesn't remember seeing. And then this was 2 years later, and he was talking about a totally different deal with aliens coming out of the ship and all this and that. No, I'm not talking about the original guy who walked up and touched it. But that reminded me of somebody out of the blue, and it made it sound more miraculous. It was more of an amazing story than the original report, which you were just talking about the guy who came on your show. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, and
there's plenty of guys who put out nonsense there. Give them an inch and they take a mile. And there's nothing we can do about that except demand some verification of the basic claims, you know, like proving you were there kind of thing. And
yeah, but Stan, I think a lot of those are doing it under instructions. I think a lot, not all, but a lot of the people that come out with the fantastic embellishments, a lot of times, if you could really track down why they're doing it, they were ordered to do so. It's part of that put some garbage out there, and everyone will throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that does happen. And, you know, people have to look at things carefully. And it's why, you know, I have references in my papers and in my books. In my Top Secret Magic book, there's a 10-page bibliography.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. We'll be on Final Approach. That means if you plan to call, you better call, because we'll get out of time real quick. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. The telephone line is open at 623-444-5889. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller. Caller has vacated the line. 623-444-5889 or toll free at 888-223-4599. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, Kevin, it's Rick from Kentucky.
Hi, Rick.
How you doing?
Good.
I had something that came to mind today that we haven't talked about before. As a paramedic in Kentucky, we have to be certified by FEMA and incident command protocols.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if either one of you have ever seen the FEMA handbook, but there is a section in it on how to handle a crashed UFO or extraterrestrial vehicle.
You have seen this?
It's in FEMA's handbook.
Yeah, you have seen it yourself, right?
I've got a copy of it.
Have you seen that, or are you aware of that?
Firefighters?
Yes, for firefighters and rescue.
Yeah, I've seen that. And, you know, the section, their discussion of UFOs wasn't too high class, but it makes sense that you'd have, that could be one of the things that happens.
It's the only federal document I've ever seen that it even mentions crashed vehicles or whatever.
Well, it's sort of interesting that FEMA would put that into that handbook if the official position of the U.S. government were correct, which is there are no UFOs.
Yeah, that's it's kind of strange. I'll make a copy of the page and send it to you, Kevin, so you can look at it.
All right, thanks. You have seen that yourself, Stanton?
Yes, I've seen it several years ago. It's been around for some time. And every once in a while, somebody brings it up as indicating that some parts of the government at least seem to be prepared, which is probably a very good idea.
Well, I've seen pictures of the pages on the internet, and I've read where people say, oh, this is bogus. But here we've got a guy who is a certified rescuer and was issued a copy of the manual, and he says it's in there, so it's not bogus, apparently. All right, Yeah. All right, this will be our final call for the evening because of the time constraints. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Brandon from Houston.
Hi, Brandon.
Hi, Stan. It's nice to talk to you.
Pleasure.
I have a question regarding your radiation background. In all your years' experience, have you actually come across trace evidence that actually had radiation levels significantly higher than the background radiation levels? And, you know, which cases were those and what kind of radiation levels would we be talking about?
Well, actually, the Rendlesham Forest case was mentioned, and there were higher than background levels measured there. And I was on a program with Colonel Halt, who was the deputy base commander. And he made that point that where this thing had come down, or it took off from, actually, the radiation levels were significantly higher than the control samples not far away. Ted Phillips has some cases with higher radiation. Nothing that I can have heard about was what I would call dangerous. Because you can measure it doesn't mean it's dangerous. Radiation is all over the place all the time. And, if you sleep with somebody for a year, you get a significant, not dangerous, significant level of radiation. Because we're all radioactive. And so we got to be careful about that. I have seen no particular, even though I worked on nuclear airplanes and nuclear rockets, there is one case, the Cash Landrum case down in Texas, where a family, a woman and her grandson and her woman friend, saw this thing close to them in the sky. Later, all kinds of helicopters came around. Anyway, they developed symptoms of what I can only say was radiation exposure from this glowing thing in the sky. And I've met those people.
Was this the case that occurred in Texas where there was helicopters involved?
Yes. Yes, that's the Cash Landrum case. And there's a book by John Schussler, who is former international director of MUFON. John's even older than I am, and he's retired. I'm still going strong here.
Good case. Brandon, are you a first-time caller? Hello, Brandon? I guess he's gone. All right, I think he was a first-time caller. If so, we're glad you called. You know, one of the things that I think we may also be making a mistake about is assuming that a genuine extraterrestrial UFO would necessarily give off radiation. Maybe if we built one and were flying it, it might be giving off radiation. But if they are as advanced as we think they are, I would think that would be a problem they probably have solved.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It would be nice if they were nuclear-powered. I thought when I read my first book on the subject back in 1958, because I was working on nuclear airplanes, and if they're using it, that would help our program. But since then, there are all kinds of other approaches to propulsion that, especially for local travel, that wouldn't provide high levels of radiation. Sorry for those out there who are scared of radiation, but...
Is there anything in physics that precludes the development of quantum propulsion?
Well, I don't know how to do it. I don't know of anything that precludes it. Very little is precluded. You make enough wrong assumptions, you can preclude anything. But the idea is to make right assumptions. So, I got a lot of stuff in my gray basket, you understand. Not enough data. But the sky's the limit here. Friedman's Law. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You have to change how you do things. Lasers are not just better light bulbs, entirely different physics. The fusion rockets I worked on are not just better chemical rockets. They're use entirely different physics. So we need to be prepared to admit that we don't know everything. And every generation of ancient academics and fossilized physicists has trouble with that. But I know that there's stuff we don't know.
I say this all the time, and I catch a little bit of email hell over it. But there are no laws of physics. What we're calling laws of physics are really just descriptions of our current understanding. And some smart guy is going to come along like Einstein did and step right over what we think is a law. And then we'll have a whole new understanding and we'll say, aha, now that's a law of physics. We call them laws of physics, but they're not laws. It's a description of our current understanding of how it works.
Yes.
And someone is going to step over one or more of those laws of physics real soon, I think. I think we're getting close to that.
I think it'll be more than one.
Yeah. Well, they'll fall like dominoes, just like Newtonian laws of motion fell like dominoes. All the little ornaments that hung on it fell as well. Stanton, thanks for being with us. If you will stay on the phone for just a second, we've run out of time. Always great to have you with us, and I hope you'll be back with us again real soon.
Hope so, too.
All right, just hang on the line with me for a moment.
StantonFriedman.com.
Yeah, StantonFriedman.com. All right, folks, that's a wrap for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.